Welcome back to the Clean Sailors Podcast. Let's talk about sailing, our marine industry, and innovations towards getting it clean. I'm your host, Holly, founder of Clean Sailors and a sailor myself with a passion for the health of our mighty oceans. Through conversations with innovators, inventors, adventurers, and inspirational sailors, we're looking at those who are helping to change the way things are done. Now, the Turner twins may need little introduction. With various adventures and accolades, sea, sky, and land, they've tried, tested, endured, and pushed both themselves and resources to the maximum. A few years ago, they set out to sail to the most remote part of the Atlantic on a second-hand boat with an electric engine, testing hydrogen cells, new anti-fouling technology, and while supporting microplastic research. Let's hear more from these two professional adventurers, Ross and Hugo. Hello both, and thank you for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. So let's start with the very basics. Who are you both? What do you stand for? And what are you interested in?
We are the Turner twins. I'm Hugo. My brother is Ross. We're 35-year-old British adventurers. And why we exist, everything's focused on learning more about the world through new technology and adventures. So where most people try physical challenges, we have ticked a few of those boxes. But what we're really interested now is testing new emerging technologies in whatever capacity, whether that's on land, whether on the sea, whether in the air. And generally speaking, these technologies help fight climate change. So that's what we've been doing over the last 5 years. We have been trying to reach the pole stability, which are the most remote points on the continents and in the oceans. So it's very difficult to pigeonhole us as mountaineers or sailors or pilots because we kind of do a bit of everything. Our adventurers, and we're always trying to learn about the world.
And what then was the Blue Pole project for you? Because that was a slightly new topic, being on water and sailing.
So the Blue Pole project for us was all about pushing the boundaries of new technology. And in particular, I'm sure there's a lot of sailors out there who've heard of Ocean Vault and going electric. And we've done a number of electric adventures on two wheels, four wheels, and in the air. And we thought the marine industry is really far behind for various reasons, which is probably another podcast in itself. And we thought, can we look at, as you said, buying a secondhand boat, taking the old engine out, putting a new electric emission-free point of use engine in, and then going off and trying to get to the center of the North Atlantic doing a plastic survey. It all sounded very new, but we're so used to doing things that we've never done before, whether it's flying across Australia, electric bikes across Europe, etc. We're not afraid of learning as we go. I think Richard Branson has the best example. He says, don't worry if you don't know everything kind of at the point when you start. Learning along the way is absolutely fine and very much encouraged. So we knew we had the skill set from multiple projects before, and finding an electric engine actually was more difficult than we thought. About a month before we left in our Class 40, we had a totally different electric engine planned to get in the boat. It came from Europe, and the engineers there said, it's just not going to work. It's not going to fit. And then we're going, oh my God, you know, we've got sponsors, we've got timelines, we've got weather, we've got film crew, everything's all booked. There is a timeline that can't really shift because this wasn't obviously planned. And amazingly, we spoke to a boat builder who knew a mate of a mate, and we managed to buy an electric Ocean Vault engine off somebody else who was going to fit it onto their boat. We put it onto ours. A lot of work went into sorting that out. And it was really interesting. It's always hindsight that you learn a lot about these projects, or the most, where you could have improved, what could have been done differently. And I think certainly the Ocean Vault, there's pros and cons for our project, but certainly it had a bit of a sticky time with performance.
To slightly geek out on the whole sailing side of it, why did you choose a Class 40?
We chose a Class 40 because I think we needed to do several thousand miles on a boat, and we wanted to do it as fast as possible, but also we wanted kind of a performance element too. Going off in comfort would have been great, and maybe in hindsight would have been really, really nice. But we've also got to think about how we're going to sell this to our sponsors and the brands that are supported. And going off on a Blue Cruiser boat didn't have the same sexiness of the appeal to a Class 40. So yeah, it was really a time scale and marketing, really, is why we chose a Class 40. And we chose secondhand, A, because of cost, and B, why shouldn't we be able to use a secondhand boat and do it up and learn more about it? I mean,
we knew that we were going to have to strip the whole engine out and all the technology to put everything back in. And if you're going to create a new one, that's fine, but it takes a long time. And we wanted to get a boat as quickly as possible and do a project on our timeline rather than boat builder's timeline.
It would have been nice to do it on a Swan or an Oyster without the same appeal or foiling, as we've just been talking about. But it is an exceptionally great boat, right? And it's well trodden in terms of offshore sailing, particularly in racing, certainly for the number of crew, et cetera, that you had. But I think what made me smile when you were mentioning it, Hugo, was also having the element of your confidence in your skills and your abilities, right? Because I appreciate that, or I imagine both of you aren't necessarily sailors to the degree in which you label yourself as such. But the fact that you would pull this together, not only just doing the sailing and heading out mid-Atlantic, which in itself is not a small ordeal, but actually the work on the boat, you had quite a bit to do to prepare the vessel.
We took the boat delivery from the US and it was run by an old charity organization in North Carolina. And we stripped the boat back to a hull ourselves and then rebuilt it ourselves from the bottom up. It was a good challenge. Nothing like scared us there. The frustrating thing with some of the rebuild, particularly when it comes to composites and engine and all that stuff, is we needed specialists for that. And because of the time of the year, I think it was spring, everyone was super, super busy getting all the other boats and commitments they had elsewhere sorted first before they could tend to us. So there was that frustrating lag in terms of we want it done today, but they can't do it until 3 weeks' time. But no, we loved it. It was really important that it was secondhand because there's a huge, huge environmental impact of building a new boat. And there's nothing that the old boat couldn't do that a new boat could do. We spoke to a director, an ex-director of the Volvo Ocean Race, and we were saying what boat to go for. We were going to go for a Figaro 2, about a 30-foot boat. And he said, well, why don't you kind of double it, make it bigger? As Hugo said, a little bit sexier. Brands might then actually go, well, because maybe there's a little bit more boat and a little bit more money, it's taken a little bit more seriously. And we said, what's the difference between a new boat, old boat, benefits? And the biggest thing that kind of stuck with us, he said, new boats break on the day one, old boats break on day one. You never, ever know. You can't tell. And so we thought, well, if it's going to break, we might as well break a secondhand boat rather than, you know, we've watched the TJV and then they're pulling into port in A Coruña or somewhere going, yeah, I've broken the boat and it's a brand new multi-million pound boat. So the benefit of a secondhand boat, there was ample benefits to a secondhand boat rather than using a brand new one.
I think also it's the opportunity that you had to work on it yourselves. And to appreciate, most may not have done that, right? Seasoned sailors often, you know, will tweak various bits and pieces and be able to fix the rudimentary, but being able to strip it back and build it back the way that you did it in not an insubordinate amount of time, I might add, before your passage, also I imagine gave you confidence that if anything were to go wrong whilst you were out there, that you knew exactly what to do and where to look.
We took it completely apart. Every single fitting fixture took it completely apart. So yeah, that is another benefit of doing it, albeit it was incredibly stressful and we were living on the boat down at Saxon Wharf, doing her up. Yeah, every morning we'd have cups of coffee, eggy bread on the stern, and then crack on with the day. And we'd finish about 7-8 o'clock at night, do it again 5 days a week for a couple of months. Just a seriously, seriously long time.
Very cool. I've got a big smile on my face, not that people will be able to see, but I can see how just from start to finish, this would have been such an adventure for you both. And just getting really into it rather than just being given a boat, couple of crew, taking you out somewhere. I understand the theme of you both to get your hands dirty.
I think the other side of the Class 40, we've done a fair bit of sailing on the south coast in Bonitos and Janos from 30 foot to 45 foot. I've sailed the Atlantic and got about 10,000 miles of sailing. And so for us, yes, there's certainly a point at which our skill level was above and below par, depending on what boat we wanted to go for. We sailed in a Figaro 2 because, as I said earlier, that's the boat we wanted to go for. It's simple enough, it's small enough, it's manageable. And then we thought, you know, as Marcus said, double your dreams, aim big, get the right crew around you if you can. And there's not, yes, obviously the performance. Yeah, if you really want to thrash a Class 40, you can go extremely quickly and things can get quite spicy. But as long as you sail within your comfort zone, you can bring the sail in, you can make it slower, you can sail a little bit more into wind, etc. So there's certainly areas of our sailing experience that has limitations, but nothing you couldn't adjust while you were sailing a boat of the Class 40 variety.
I understand. Shrewd decision. We were talking about quotes, obviously, prior to recording, and you just said a fantastic one there, which was double your dream, aim big. So I think we can note that one down. You had this great, speedy, well-built Class 40 boat, secondhand, and you took out the engine and replaced it with an electric one. You touched on that earlier, Ross, but I do want to hear more from both of you about what drove the decision in the first place, actually installing this new engine into the boat, what that process was like, easy, difficult, and ultimately also what then the outcome was by having an electric engine on board a sailing boat, which you were sailing offshore.
At the heart of every project, we want to use new technology, and we hadn't experienced firsthand or heard of anyone we know that had used an electric engine. Having looked online about the pros and cons of it, there's a lot of different reviews. So we wanted to find out firsthand the actual benefits of that. Secondly, that definitely helped with the buy-in from partners, because there was that environmental, the sustainable element of the project, which they could tell their story as well through that. So we went to Ocean Vault, we installed the engine, which was a nightmare trying to get out the old diesel engine just with the two of us. At least if we broke the diesel engine, it wasn't too much of a problem because it was completely old and knackered. But one surprise that we had was in the engine mount, because the boat had come from South Carolina on the east coast of the States. We took the engine mount off and there was a nest of brown widows and black widow spiders all over the boat, which was quite an interesting one because we didn't really know what to do.
What did you do?
We put them in a Tupperware box and put them on the back of the boat for a week or two as pets. And I think they all died of cold because it's miserable and cold in the UK.
Lucky you're still here. So in terms of actually then installing the electric engine in the diesel engine's place, like how was that? You get some support from it, presumably?
Yeah, we had an amazing engineer called Wayne, who spent weeks on the boats, early mornings, late nights, hair all pulled out because of stress. But it's a system. It's a system that they've given some time and thought to, because essentially you're going to be converting all the boats, or most of the boats they put these electric drives in, will be replacing the diesel engine. So they fit in place pretty easily. We had a bit of fiberglass work to do on the core of the boat. But other than that, it was literally diesel engine out, and Z drive electric motor in, plus the batteries. The batteries went where the diesel fuel went. In theory, that was straightforward, and it's not impossible. You don't have to completely re-engineer the boat. So it's very thought out. It took, a good week or two to actually install the electric drive, the batteries, the engine management system, the throttle, the controls, the wiring. Yeah, there's a lot of work that goes in. I think in principle, we all think, oh, it's an electric motor, a battery, on-off switch, and forward and backwards, and off you go. But they had to calculate the polars of the boat, so the hull shape in the water, what the velocity of the boat would be at a certain given kilowatt hour or power outage, what the capacity of the batteries were in order to give you range. And we were trying some Finchulate, the new anti-foul, as well. So that was all quite a mystery. And because the boat, I think, was 2009, it was 37, hull number 37 of the Class 40s. They didn't have the exact polars, so I think they took the polars from a 2013 boat. So yeah, there was a lot of unknowns, but that's the world that we like living in the sense that if there are lots of unknowns, that's exactly where we need to be with these projects.
Lots of unknowns. I'm smiling again because most people appreciate would like the opposite. I'd love to hear also about the hydrogen cell technology, because that was something else that you were testing on this boat. How did that interact just in general with your passage, and what utility came out of it for you?
The hydrogen was really interesting, and definitely still today. Hydrogen is really, really almost conceptual. There's a few boats out there, the America's Cup chase support boats, using hydrogen at the highest technology level and speed, amazingly. But apart from that, hydrogen on a boat on a small scale, some of the ferries in the kind of island transportation are looking at hydrogen. But we had to try and find a hydrogen fuel cell for a boat, which is no mean feat at a certain price point. So we spoke to Phil Sharp, the sailor who's got his own Imoca now, hydrogen. And then we started looking at the cost of that, thinking, you know, that's just wild, absolutely wild. As he said, we're not professional sailors at on his level. So what alternatives are there? So we actually ended up speaking to a company called TCP Eco, based in where they've got a number of satellite offices around the UK. And they use a huge amount of hydrogen for residential roadworks, rail works, where noise needs to be kept to a low. And they use thousands, literally thousands, of fuel cells around the country. So we spoke to them and said, can we fit one of your fuel cells into the boat to charge the electric motor or batteries? And then obviously that powers the motor. And after a bit of jiggery pokery, they were like, okay, as long as the fuel cell stays totally dry, and one of the big concerns was that salt vapor kills hydrogen engines almost instantly. And so we took the punt, we installed it, and if anyone knows what an Anderson lead is, it's quite literally just negative on negative, positive on positive, and that trickle charged the batteries. So we could charge the batteries by about 1.2 kilowatts an hour, and that would last one canister of hydrogen would be about 6 hours worth of charging. And only 250 grams of hydrogen was in that canister. So really dense in energy. And so we could almost double our battery capacity with 500 grams of hydrogen. In theory, that was wonderful. But, you know, when you start getting lots and lots of canisters on board, it starts becoming a little bit of a logistical nightmare. I say credit where credit's due, Hug. We did really well in finding an alternative. Bearing in mind, this fuel cell was not marine. It was for industrial use, commercial use on railway and motorways and residential areas. It was not a marine, but we managed to make it work, which was really cool.
Yeah, it's very impressive, hey? Incredibly impressive. I think it's also one of those elements where, as you said, it's, again, we're more familiar with it operating in a, firstly, non-leisure marine environment, let's say. And I think that's something that is really interesting also about the electric, is how this technology is actually being employed on almost the everyday for the everyday persons, if you like. Because I appreciate that the premise of sort of electric engines in boats in particular is not new, and nor was it entirely new sort of when you were trying it. Oceanvolt's obviously a well-established entity now, but it's still slightly controversial for a couple of reasons, as it is on land, right, with our cars and hybrids versus EVs, etc. How was the electric engine for you? How did it fare? Obviously the hydrogen is battery support, but the electric engine, you can't go without it. And how was that?
The electric engine was great. Well, firstly, I actually haven't thought of this for ages since we did the project. We had no gas stoves or anything on the boat. We could just run kettles and all electrical appliances from the battery, which was oddly really nice to do. Like, you didn't have to bother with starting little stoves or anything. It was just kettle straight on. So that made cooking and eating quite simple. As far as the performance goes, so we had 11 kilowatt hours of battery, and you can have as much kilowatt hours of battery as you possibly would like. Obviously, there's a huge cost to lithium ion batteries, so we had to balance cost and range. And we had these polars on estimated range from Oceanvolt for a class 40. So I think it was about 50 to 60 miles. They said we could do, using the electric motor with 11 kilowatt hours of battery, at about 5 knots. So 5 knots, 50 nautical miles, that's pretty good for getting in and out. Okay, fine, in theory. Reality was, I don't think they got the polars exactly right for the shape of the hull. We were also trialing Finchulate and doing some testing for them with the new antifoul. So that increased drag, but the drag, they said, would be very minimal. So I've got it all written down here because there are a lot of numbers. But in short, and in reality, this is what the engine power ended up being, or performance, which, so between 2 and 3 knots we could go for, but with 11 kilowatt hours of battery, we could probably only get 10 to 15 miles, nautical miles on that, which is a problem if you're doing 2-3 knots and you've got a knot of tide, 2 knots of tide against you, which you're not really moving. And there are a couple of times going in and out of the Solent where we weren't really making much in the way of headway. So 11 kilowatt hours of battery. So in simple terms, if you're using or at an engine run rate of 5.5 kilowatts an hour, you can run that battery for 2 hours and that's you done. So if you can run it at 2 kilowatt hours, and we were trying to find the sweet spot in terms of as lower RPM as possible, but maximum speed for that RPM, was around about 2.3 kilowatts an hour. So there's about just over 5 hours worth of cruising. It was just really, really tricky to understand. The reality of the boat is 10 to 15 miles. If you're trying to get out of the Solent, you're just about doing that. If you find it's too windy, you've got a problem, then you're not getting back to your home port. That was the challenge that we were trying to balance. We also had the hydrogen fuel cell on the boat, which obviously gave us a charge of 1.2 kilowatt hours per hour, which if you took that off the 2 kilowatt hours an hour that you're actually burning, your net loss is only about 1 kilowatt per hour, which gives you a cruise time of 11 hours, but you're only doing 2 knots, 3 knots. And if you're balancing the tide again, that's the reality and the issues that we had to constantly think about. It's like, right, if we're leaving port, you know, our bingo point, i.e. we can only do half the range because we need to get back. So that was a real, real challenge. But again, it's exactly what the project was setting out to achieve. You know, we weren't proving that sailing as a concept works, because we all know that. It's actually, right, what can we learn from the engine? What can we learn from the system that we've put on the boat? And how can we share that and tell people, right, well, this is the challenges. This is, you know, line in the sand. This is where you can improve on in the future.
Right. It's an exceptional opportunity. You're not necessarily there to prove anything. It's just to try it, which is why it's so refreshing to talk to you, because I think there's an element of, certainly in the industry in general, and certainly because there's a lot of, in some places, pressure, but certainly some encouragement for sailors in particular to sort of be moving towards electric engines. I mean, I think we're seeing it globally still, certainly in the West, that the electric is the answer to all of our problems. That does warrant a different podcast, because it's so heavily contested and there's such a variety of things that go into that. But that's why it's so cool to talk to you both, because I also appreciate more recently you've had an opportunity to try those kind of electric engines in a very different kind of vessel, obviously a lot shorter range vessel, which I want to talk about in a second. On the element of electric and offshore in particular, you're right. I mean, you are battling wind and tide. You could be in a circumstance, an emergency situation where it's not 5 hours isn't enough. Having, for example, you've done the Atlantic, rather than having done the Biscay 3 or 4 times myself now, anything goes wrong, you've got days, and you may need to be having engine power for days in circumstances which, you know, are well out of your control. So I can see how on sailing yachts, particularly offshore, the electric capacity works for short range, popping around the coast, hey, I'm just going to motor in. Even the Solent, I mean, the tidal rate, did the Celtic Sea up to Scotland earlier this summer. And I mean, it's nuts outside the Bristol Channel. It's absolutely nuts. I've not quite experienced sort of sea state like it. I don't see how an electric engine could fare in those circumstances. A diesel one almost didn't. It was strong.
I certainly agree that there's the limitations if you start looking at like more remote, closer environment like the Inner Hebrides, Outer Hebrides, the islands off mainland Scotland with such limited range. As Hugo said, it's that 5. I don't think you should think of an electric engine in kilowatts. It's nautical miles, and 11 nautical miles was our like comfortable max distance at 2 to 3 knots. You know, you're taking 5 hours to do it, which is, you know, you get a knot and a half plus a little bit of breeze and you're going nowhere. Extra juice and you're literally using it up in half an hour. So it was that really, and people were saying, well, it's a sailing boat, sail within those limitations, have that mindset of the pioneers 150 years ago. Yeah, but look how many times they got shipwrecked. I think for people to adopt modern technology or to use an electric engine, yes, you can add more batteries on at vast expense. I think it's about, was it £1,000 per kilowatt, roughly? Which a lot of people don't have that much money to put into, for instance, if it's a 25, 30 foot sailing boat, the cost of an electric engine that we put on our Class 40 is arguably half, at least half the cost of the boat itself.
It's a fascinating topic and I could chat about it for ages. It's really interesting because also, you said it, I mean, it's a sailing boat, so operate within the parameters of sailing. And I think that's one of the, you know, really in a circumstance, if one buys a sailing boat or one sails, that's what you're there for. So the engine really is getting in and out of maneuverability emergency scenarios. So you really want something that you can rely on. Flipping forward to obviously short range vessels, and you mentioned even island hopping, we've talked about, you know, the America's Cup chase boats. You can see a circumstance in which those, you know, electric boats, hydrofoiling ones too, it kind of makes sense. Tell me about your experience at Goodwood.
So we had the opportunity to go down and be on a Candela 8 or a C8 hydrofoiling electric, should we say, power boat. We've been looking at other projects that push the boundaries on water. So hydrofoils, electric or hydrogen powered. And this product we saw 2 or 3 years ago, it was very elementary. It was certainly pushing the boundaries of hydrofoil electric speedboats. And once you get into that hydrofoil position, the efficiencies go through the roof. The downside is if there's a log or something, you're going to break the hydrofoil and therefore, but that aside, it was really exciting to have the opportunity to get on this hydrofoiling boat. It's about 800 kilos, the whole boat. is the Hull. You put the batteries in straight from a Polestar car. That's one of their partnerships they have. So they're just combining marine hull technology, car battery, which is already there. And it really is a fantastic, fantastic experience. Very, very odd. Incredibly smooth. Once you start rising out of the water, you just think, how has this not been done before? But then you start understanding what it can and cannot do. And if it's not on the foils, it has a certain range, obviously, which is nowhere near its performance range when it's up on the hydrofoils. So any sort of long distance open ocean passage, dare I say, across the channel, you know, if you have damage on a hydrofoil or the weather is too choppy for the hydrofoil, then the battery performance really starts then coming into play. It's not like a rib where you can just smash through the waves for hours and hours. It is beautiful. It is really, really exciting. And if that's the way marine technology is going, I certainly think running a diesel or petrol engine on a hydrofoil system like that is definitely, I think, the middle ground between the vast weight of a battery and the limitations on energy storage. So that's what I would think. Would you agree, putting a diesel or a petrol engine on a hydrofoil?
Yeah, the tricky one is you have probably quite a lot of draw on a foiling boat, should we say, because you've got to have the foils in the water. Coastal environments, you're probably going to get a lot more people hitting rocks and ordnance in the water. But from a fuel efficiency perspective, yeah, it's miles ahead of, you know, traditional displacement hulls.
Miles and miles. You're right. The draft of those boats is a bit obscene. I'm also not at this stage advocating that they're available for popular use. But also just for professional services, because I appreciate, you know, foiling itself is not something that's, I mean, it's bloody fast, let's put it that way. There's a whole new range of elements that open up around the, let's say, the safety aspects of foiling and otherwise. But I think there's an interesting point, and I read, looking at the research, and even The Economist has done a lot of stuff recently around sort of hybrids versus EVs. And whilst the hybrid market is the highest at the moment, certainly on land, because I think psychologically, and also proof is in the pudding, that having sort of the diesel, petrol, fossil fuel option alongside electric is really useful, not least because of exactly what we talked about, which is range. But what the economists are expecting over time, and the market research is showing, that it's legislation that will force hybrids out. And there's already some countries who said by 20, as early as 2035, hybrids shouldn't be available on the market. And they're actually advocating that car companies will have to stop making and selling hybrid cars by 2035. So despite the utility of even marrying the two at times, it looks like the general trend will be the complete abolition of fossil fuel powered vessels, vehicles as we know it, all for battery powered. Obviously, we're safe with sail for a little while longer. But it's incredibly interesting because, as you said, the marine industry is, there is a lot of innovation going on, but it is somewhat behind the times, to the extent that how is the industry going to accommodate such legislation over time? Because it's a colossal shift. I mean, not least because of the amount of waste. I mean, we've known about this for cars for, you know, decades now, and there's been, you know, a lot of discouragement at times between different governments of diesel and petrol. But this is coming quite quickly, and actually, you know, there's 30 plus million registered boats on the planet, and those are ones that are registered, most of which have traditional engines in them. It's not an insubstantial ask to waste things that are, you know, still in good working order for something which technology, which is yet to be proven, certainly at scale and over long distance.
There's certainly a lot of room for synthetic hydrocarbons. I know there's Porsche and a few other partners of theirs are putting in a huge amount of money into capturing carbon dioxide and putting hydrogen with it to make a synthetic fuel, petrol, diesel, aviation fuel. And I was reading an article on some electric.com website, really interesting, and they were talking about how synthetic fuels could help companies and individuals reduce their carbon footprint by having this as a supplementary fuel source. It fits into existing infrastructure. It can be carried at low pressure in small volumes, large volumes. It can be made on site. So there's no need for having big merchant oil vessels and container ships flying around the world and fractional distillation units, all of that stuff. Really exciting, because you imagine trying to put 30 million electric engines and batteries into boats. It's just not going to even happen in a century. And the cost of that and the cost of these, shall I say, lower end boats, there's no point in doing it. Whereas if you can get a synthetic fuel, you know, you don't need to change anything at all, anything at all. You're reducing the amount of infrastructure used to make that. But as long as that hydrocarbon or synthetic fuel can be made from green energies, wind, solar, etc., winner, winner, chicken dinner, in my opinion.
Well said. I haven't heard that phrase in a long time, but it's a delicious one. I think it's terrifying to hear you repeat that back to me about putting some electric engines in the 30 plus million registered boats we've got out there is terrifying. I mean, this isn't just supporting an electric movement, it's also supporting an environmental degradation. I mean, that's also another element of electric, which we as a species are yet to conquer, is actually how we make it work without degrading some of the most fragile ecosystems on our planet. I mean, you mentioned the cost of lithium is exceptionally high. Other factors like cobalt, I think Ross, you and I talked about this before, is found in some of the most remote and undesirable, arguably, areas on the planet, such as the deep sea, which we haven't touched yet. I mean, a species down there, you know, there's a ton of stuff, research finally being done now in response to the concept of sort of deep sea mining becoming a little bit of a greater reality, let's say. But to actually achieve an electric revolution would be at great cost. I think there's a lot of work that we still need to do to understand. And like you said, that so the mention of synthetic fuels could be really interesting and obviously a lot less impactful, let's say, on ecosystems which we haven't touched before.
It's the cumulative use of antifouls as well. When we think about not just the practical side and then the financial side of making every marine vessel emission-free, shall we say, it's just when you add up 30 million times, let's just say, how many litres of antifoul does a boat leach over a year? Should we just say 1 litre is very conservative? Imagine 30,000 litres of antifoul going into the water every year. But then you start adding on all the massive merchant vessels and the tons of chemical components that come off each one of those. And there's, I don't know, probably 30,000 of those. If you put the amount of antifoul going into the water every day in one kind of overspill, we'd stop using antifoul tomorrow. We really would. But because it's such a small amount, which we can't see spread over the ocean, we always use the analogy, humans are like the frog. If you put a frog into cold water and slowly boil it, it'll kill it. Whereas if you put a frog into boiling water, it will just jump straight out. And we are that frog that is slowly boiling itself alive. We're just not, you know, well, there's a little change here and there, it's not going to do anything. And then you get to that point where you're like, well, we're just too far gone.
And this is the interesting thing where legislation comes in, isn't it? It's often very slow. But to your point about antifoul, I mean, we've obviously worked with, this is kind of why Clean Sailors exists, number one. And secondly, the premise of antifoul is an interesting one because there's so much research that shows that our boats are leaving almost vapor trails through water. So it is identifiable if you know what you're looking for and have the sort of equipment to pick it up. But we do leave the equivalent of airplane vapor trails in water sailing around with antifoul because it is, you know, shedding. What we're also finding, I've just had a great conversation with Dr. Karina Chokhan, who's looking at basically composite materials. And what we're finding is our boats are also constantly shedding glass fibers, which obviously have its own consequences for the environment. So I'll send you the link to those two because you might be interested. But it's fascinating because now we're starting to understand the depth of the spread and the gravity of the impact of our industry and what our, you know, our hobbies, our passions, our pastime is. I mean, it's deeply embedded in so many cultures, particularly in countries in Europe, the Netherlands, France, the UK in particular. Sailing and boating is huge. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of years old. But we can't go on the way that we have been doing, not least because of the number of people now doing it, and not least because we've built so many wonderful technologies and materials that were built to last, and we really can't afford for them to anymore.
Yeah, we've definitely got to have more change, and people have got to be open to the idea of change. And one thing that is a lasting impression from sailing Nuna, our class 40 yacht, that had an electric motor powered by hydrogen, it's exactly the same way as we drive electric cars. You just have to change the way you drive. You have to change the way you sail as well. And it's that mindset change going into the situation, knowing you've got a limited amount of energy on the boat, knowing that you can only do a limited amount of miles before a decision needs to be made, knowing that you've got to plan your passage and your route around weather differently to if you had a petrol engine, because the result of running out of petrol is far less, you know, the likelihood is almost zero. So it's that mindset change, that constantly thinking differently, which is where we're all going to have to go at some point in our lives, is change the way we live. People, they don't like change because it's uncomfortable. So that's the lasting impression. It was, we just had to change the mindset with which we sailed the boat. And once you get around that hurdle, then it becomes, okay, yeah, well, we can sail within the limitations of the boat, the limitations of the battery and the electric motor. And it's still possible. It's just, you just got to take a little longer. You've got to plan a bit more, but that's the challenge.
It's a huge one. And it's an almost incredibly poignant way to conclude our conversation, because you're right, for, you know, for millions of years or thousands of years, certainly as modern societies, we've had to adapt to what we had around us, very crudely, literally what we had around us. And therefore, if the parameters change, we learn to reoperate within those parameters. And is this another example of, you know, an environment, an ecosystem and an industry which needs to shift those parameters and we just start doing things differently within them? I think it's incredibly poignant and it works both ways. It works with technology, but it also works with just our basic resources. It's certainly an exciting time. I think, like you said, the innovation, the technology is what you're both about, certainly. But what that does is actually make all of these kind of opportunities possible, and solving real life problems with things that can be scalable and that can be useful is a great spot to be in.
People just need to, in our opinion, and what we've found whenever we go on a new project, whether it's land, air and sea, using new emission-free technologies, we always try to read up as much as we can around that industry or project or product or service. I think the biggest thing with emission-free point of use, etc., is get educated. Just because somebody says, you know, this is great, electric car, great, you know, there's no emissions, it's super clean, that's the front page. What's the second page? You're exporting your carbon footprint somewhere else. 60% or thereabouts of the UK power grid is not green. So where's that being charged and what carbon dioxide is that giving off? You know, I think once you get skin deep, and people are very easily persuaded going, oh, it's emission free, go and do it. Educate yourself. Don't be naive about it. Is a second hand used vehicle, petrol or diesel, better for the environment than creating a brand new EV? Is an electric hand dryer in the loo better than a towel? Is it? I don't know. There's always a other side of the coin. And I think just make an informed decision and go to sources like the government website where you can get information that's, you know, from highly regarded professionals or global institutes that know what they're talking about. Don't go on what somebody says on a bus sign. Yeah, that's why I buy a secondhand car. I don't want to create a new one.
Agree. What's your next adventure?
Our next adventure is going to be setting a world altitude record for an electric tandem paramotor. Think of a paraglider with a big lawnmower engine on your back. And we've created and developed with a UK company called Parajet to build a fully electric one, which has 5.8 kilowatt hours of battery capacity with some funky electric motors. Yeah, we've been testing it over the last month or two, heading out to French Alps in France to set an altitude record. So we're aiming for about 10,000 feet.
Wow, that's impressive. Can I have your job?
Yes.
Okay, well, Hugo and Ross Turner, thank you both so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure to learn from you and with you on this topic of your Blue Pole adventure and the technology surrounding marine and sailing so far. I'm really looking forward to hearing about your next watery one. And until then, please stay safe and I hope you make 10,000 feet.
Thank you very much for having us.
You've been listening to the Clean Sailors podcast. For information on all episodes and for more about Clean Sailors, head to cleansailors.com. Thank you for listening and see you for the next episode.